I actually did a small experiment. Hasn't been published as well, of course. It's just in my numbers, but I asked a lot of the guys who is the best operator, and you get some names, you know. And I got a name list of about 10 operators that tended to be mentioned often by the others as a very good soldier, very good operator. They were about average on the testing. The best guys, they maybe, what can you say? They tend to spend more time on themselves.
Team, welcome back to another week with Drew and Alex here on the Mops and Mo's podcast. As ever, we are thrilled to have you. And I believe, Alex, you had some thoughts on Costco.
I do have thoughts on Costco. I, first of all, love Costco, so I don't want this to come off as ripping on Costco.
That's fine. I hate
But
Costco. So
despite the really, well,
I
we'll have to go
hate
back and forth on
Costco.
that in a second. But
Hate Costco.
one of my struggles with Costco is the unpredictability of what they're stocking for particular products. Certain products are always there. You're safe with those. You don't have to worry about it. But every now and then they'll get a fantastic product and I'll be like, oh man, this is great. Get it at a great price, get it a big quantity. Awesome. It's a staple now. And then, like a month or two later, they just don't have it anymore. I'll specifically shout out if people aren't using, I mean, Drew probably makes his own pasta sauce, so he's not using it, but
I
Rao's pasta
do.
sauce is freaking fantastic. It's a
I
local
do.
Colorado brand. I love them. They carry it, but for a while there, Costco had some fantastic Rao's eggplant parm, and I love an eggplant parm, but it's a messy meal to create at home. And so it's nice to have a faster alternative that doesn't have a bunch of crazy stuff in it. Rouse is awesome. And so they just stopped carrying it all of a sudden. And I went up to the like customer service people and I asked, like, hey, what's up? Like, you used to have this, now it's gone. What's going on? And their answer was, we sold through our commitment to that product. And I started losing my mind. Not at them, like it's not their fault, but like you sold too much of it, so you stopped stocking it. Like, that sounds like a situation where you would keep stocking it because it's awesome. I don't know. Maybe there's not enough of it produced that they can stock it at other locations, but
Well,
man, that made me sad.
I mean, just really quickly, I want to point out, yes, I make my own pasta sauce. Reason for that is exactly as you mentioned, which is you're looking for a sauce that has normal stuff in it, right? So you flip that can over, it's literally like four things. So just combine the four things and you've made your own pasta sauce. It could not be easier. So yeah, I make my own pasta sauce. Secondly,
I
why
mean,
I
it
hate,
could be easier. I could have like six bottles of Rao's sauce in my pantry.
but they've sold through their quota. I hate Costco because it is, to me, the epitome of just the stupidity of American consumerism. Like everything, and I say this from like a business standpoint. I've listened to a lot of podcasts and read books on sort of the structure of Costco as a company. And I think it's brilliant. Like they're doing exactly, there's a reason why the parking spots at Costco are 10 feet wide. Like everything's intentional, which just pisses me off because then it's like we as a culture feel that we need to go to this place and buy a freaking pallet of toilet paper because that's what this company's telling me. I also say that as somebody who lives in a place where Costco is like an hour away. So like you're literally, it sounds like old fashioned, but like we go into town to go to the Costco and I'll have none of it. So anyway, you'll not find me at Costco.
I used to live in places where Costco was an hour away, and now I live in a better place where Costco is close by and it's easy.
And you're just surrounded by miserable corporate American Costco consumers. And I'm over here making my own pasta sauce.
I disagree. Oh,
Speaking of,
God. You're so proud of yourself.
I am proud of myself. Speaking of non-Americans, is that a segue? I don't know. I don't
That was a pretty rough attempt at a segue.
know. Who do we have this week?
So we have Paul Solberg. He has a master's in sports psychology and a PhD in health psychology and physiology from the Norwegian School of Sports Sciences. He's also an accomplished athlete in his own right. He represented Norway as a javelin thrower and also competed nationally in handball, powerlifting, and weightlifting. It's rare that you see a crossover
Can I just
powerlifter and Olympic lifter.
let me pause real quick. for people who don't know what handball is, like go look that up on YouTube. That sport is awesome.
For sure. It has like a tiny foothold in the US, but it's much bigger in
it
Europe.
Is
it is
awesome.
Worth checking out. Yeah.
Anyway.
So after his athletic career, he coached for several of the best track and field throwers in Norway. And these days, he is the head of the strength department at the Norwegian Olympic Training Center and head of strength and power for the Norwegian Olympic Committee. But we're not going to focus on that. We're going to focus on his previous role. For many years, Paul was the human performance program director for what we'll refer to as NORNAVSOC. I'll offer a couple different names for it. NORNAVSOC is short for Norwegian Navy Special Operations. You can think of these guys like Norwegian Navy SEALs. And he built the program that is still in use there today. I'll attempt the actual Norwegian name.
Oh, good luck here.
Marine Jaeger Kommandoen. I'm probably
I was not
butchering
good.
That. He
you
made
guys want
much...
to bet? Yeah, he pronounces it in the episode and
yeah.
He's better.
You can abbreviate that to MJK. That's what you'll find some stuff on Google under MJK for them. Or the more badass direct translation, which is just Marine Jaegers.
Jaegers.
Pretty sweet. He's also published close to 40 peer-reviewed articles. We mentioned a couple of them in the conversation, but his research focuses on everything from muscle adaptation, recovery, power training, motivation and well-being, and one that we discuss a little bit here, reliability of fitness testing measures.
And I think I mentioned this in the outro, which if folks are not familiar, if you listen beyond the closing music for all of these episodes where we have guests, Alex and I add a little bit on the end, just kind of giving our closing thoughts. And Paul is what I would consider a cerebral strength coach in that he is very intelligent, very analytical, very fluid with his approach to, you could say training, but I think more broadly, just kind of his approach to managing the athlete. And a lot of that shines through here. What I thought was particularly interesting, and we talked to him about this before we recorded and then also while recording, but if you think about it, all of the paradigms that you and I have talked about around strength and conditioning stem from American strength and conditioning. And so here we have an individual who not only didn't, one, he didn't grow up in this culture. He's not American. He's from Norway. But as an athlete himself, was raised in an entirely different paradigm around human performance. And so what was kind of fun to tease out is how did that play into his approach to building a tactical human performance program? Because he's not thinking about football, basketball, baseball. He's thinking more analytically. And there's probably a multitude of episodes we could have on just that topic.
Yeah, I really hope that this episode drives a lot of conversations in the space. We want to hear from you guys. Hopefully you guys are talking to each other and things like that. But I think this one is a starting point for some important conversations in how we implement programs in this space.
Yeah. So with that, enjoy our conversation with Paul. When I was in Scandinavia, that was the only time I'd eaten raw herring or pickled herring.
Raw and pickled are different things
of some sort on an open-faced sandwich. There's an
pickled
herring is
a big thing up there, though.
There's an obsession with open-faced sandwiches. See, he gets it. We're very Scandinavian over here.
Yeah.
can we start this by, I guess, in as much as you're actually allowed to explain some of the background of NORNAVSOC? I don't want to sell it short by just saying Norwegian Navy SEALs, but like, can you sort of explain what it is, NORNAVSOC?
Yep, it's in Norway we have two special forces groups. So it's one army group and one navy group, and that's the Norwegian Navy Special Operations Command, or NORNAVSOC. I was stationed for 6-7 years. They have two bases in Norway. So, we use both camps. It's people on both of them, of course.
So To prepare for this conversation, I was watching Magnus Mittbo videos. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a former professional rock climber.
Yep.
And one of his was with the Coastal Ranger Commandos. Are they part of Nordnafsok?
We collaborate with them, and a lot of the guys have taken their first year with the Coastal Rangers, and then they join the selection for the special forces after that.
So what you're saying is Nordnafsok is like a level that Coastal Rangers Commandos try to get to.
Yes.
Oh, that's nuts, because I'll suggest for listeners to go check out Magnus Mittbo's video with
Put
the
our show
Ranger
notes.
Commandos. Their PT test, I could only dream of having something like this. As like, we're talking barbell walking lunges, we're talking weighted pull-ups, a pretty crazy swim test where they just chuck you off a moving boat.
So it's extremely hard. As I say, most guys that comes are prepared. They have usually been in the military for some years, and then they go or apply for the selection course, which starts every year. And it's a long selection. Well, the basic selection is 1 year, but usually it's closer to 2 years before they are ready. Which I think is good. I think we should prepare them well for what they meet. And we have to be sure that they are physical and mentally capable of the demands that will meet them.
I guess this is a question for this, for really the strength coaches that listen into this, because when I think about the American military and embedded human performance in the American military, oftentimes what we're looking at is this classic contractor model where other companies are supplying. And I mean, you do get into the federal civilian space where now you're actually working for the military as a civilian. For you guys and with your role, I mean, I know in speaking, you've said things like I was stationed there. Like, what does it look like to take on this role that you ultimately had? And you know, when we intro the podcast, we'll get into some of your background, but what did that look like for you?
I worked at the Norwegian Sports University. Was at the end of my PhD. A European PhD is it's total 10 years at the university, but it's 4 years after the master degree. So I was at the end of that. I teach in strength training, track and field, of course, periodization, training planning. And then one day, two Nordnafsok operators stood outside of my door and said, "You have to come with us." So I think they had checked, in Norway.
Was this like right as you were walking in for the day? They're like, you're coming with
Yeah, and
us.
one of them, he was like 2 meters and bald and really big. So I just, all right. Of course, I had to think about it, but then I thought, all right, I'll just do something else. I need to just learn from a different environment and see something else. And of course, these guys, they have a huge reputation in Norway of being really hard and tough and also really nice guys. So they offered me a position. They had tested different coaches or trainers just coming in and out, contractors as are more and more or mainly used in US. But they felt they couldn't get like a total understanding of what's really going on. So when they offered me the position, they had a position in the training wing. So I was an instructor there as all the others in the unit. After about 6 months, all the classifications, I had to be checked, of course, upside down and be able to be in the unit. And I think that was maybe one of the success criteria of what we were able to accomplish, that I could really join them, be with them, be in the camp. I was traveling with them, going through the whole selection course with the instructors. And I think that's extremely important if you really want to do a good job. It's a lot of good coaches out there, strength coaches, strength and conditioning practitioners, but As I always say, you can make the best strength program or squats program in the world, but it can be the worst program in the world as well if you don't know what they have done and what they are going to do. So that was extremely important, and the guys really took me in. One of the operators in the training wing, he was about 50% of his position was set aside to follow me for the first 6 months. Of course, I learned a lot from him as well, and we could talk about everything. I could ask questions. You need to know who the alpha males are in the group, and was able to discuss with a lot of the experienced operators, be around them, and I think that was extremely important. And I understand that's difficult sometimes in other countries, perhaps, but they had tried to do what others have done and really didn't feel it was a great success. So they wanted to try something different. And of course, I had a job already, so wasn't too interested in going in and out on a percentage position or for 1 and 1 year or. So I think that's also something that we have to bear in mind.
So just a couple of clarification questions on that unique sounding hiring process. One, did your leadership at the university know that like the Navy was there to talk to you? And then
It
two,
sounds like you got kidnapped, I
it
think,
sounds
is
like
what
you
we're
did
asking.
not, it sounds like you didn't apply. It sounds like they chose you. Is
Yeah.
that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. I think they had talked to people around. I was a national coach for the junior track and field team for throws. I had just finished my own career as an elite athlete. I was the end of my PhD, so I could, continue at the Norwegian Sports University. I had a possibility to do that, but yeah, then it was just a few months before that. They had worked, I know, for a while to get the position and get everything through, all the paperwork and everything, and they really wanted to have something to offer me, I think. So yeah, kind of, I don't know, hijacked, kidnapped, what can we say? But of course, I was nervous in the beginning. I didn't really know. You had just heard some rumors about these guys and how tough they are. And yeah, you should listen to the YouTube video of the Nordnav Sokli. It's on YouTube, I think. It's a former SEAL team operator that talks about the Nordnav Sok. It's really funny. So that was about the same I knew about them. Of course, I was a bit nervous, and you always some thoughts goes through your head. Can I actually do this? Do I have the knowledge? But I think that's also healthy to get those thoughts when you go into it. And yeah, it didn't actually. I just discussed with my, ex-wife now, but discussed should we go for this and should I do this? And then she thought also, yes, well, just do something else. And that was one of the funniest travels I've done in my life.
Can
Well, if
you,
anybody's
if any like super cool elite special operations people are listening to this podcast and want to like kidnap Drew or I for a super cool job, just show up. You guys know how to do it. You know where to find us.
Every day when I walk in, I'm like, hey, am I there? I'm ready. But I want to ask you, like, obviously for Alex and I, we've heard of Nordnavsøk, but like, I think kind of like how you were when you started there, I don't know much about the history of the unit or things like that, but it sounds like they were putting a lot of time and effort into creating a contemporary, scientifically backed human performance program. And they had experimented with a couple of different things. They found you, they pursued you, they kidnapped you ultimately. But can you speak to what historically they had been doing for training? And maybe this becomes a larger conversation about kind of what the Norwegian military at large was doing. And the reason I ask this question is because we're kind of at the same inflection point on the US side where for, I guess, the last 10, 15 years, they've been bringing in experts from outside of the military to try and introduce a tactically minded approach to human performance. And I'm just curious what that looked like for NorNavSoc specifically prior to you getting there.
Yeah, good, good question. Of course, we had a history in the Norwegian military in general, not just special forces. It's based on, of course, a lot from the Germans after the Second World War. A lot of group training, running. You're basically focus on endurance capacity. It's still a big focus in Norway. We still think that's a very important capacity to have. Of course, we have a lot of mountains, big areas to be able to walk over with a pretty heavy backpack. So, and then of course, through collaboration with other units, they saw that, all right, they are starting to do something different. A lot of the units in Norway, they don't have any, what can we say? It's getting better now last years, but it wasn't traditional to have a trainer or a coach. You had PT every morning, but you just did it after what you felt for doing, or in a group that everybody just ran 10Ks every morning. That was it. And the NorNavSoc had a history like that as well. Like every morning, 6:30 in the morning, it was a take 10K, 10 kilometer running, and then swimming a little bit in the open sea, and then you were ready for the day. So they really wanted to change that. I think it was based on both that they saw that it's different capacities now with more modern gear. You have helicopters, cars. You're often either flown in or driven in to the competition more than earlier, of course. It was, of course, the Cold War in Norway. It was a lot of scouting in up north. So then it was a lot of walking, but then it changed a bit where with the deployments to Afghanistan, of course. So it came together with what other units did, what US have done, and then they saw we need to know more about also strength and power, maybe gain some mass. And it was, of course, an injury aspect in that with extremely hard training and a lot of running and at the same time. When they really wanted to do this well and professionally. And of course, for me, with a PhD, I really needed to document everything that we changed or did. So did a lot of research, testing in the beginning. I talked to a lot of other units, a lot of friends in US, of course, to discuss with both what they felt had worked and not, and that also helped a lot, of course.
So I do want to take a step back because you're describing problems that are very similar to things that the US military has dealt with, but I've had lots of conversations with people about how we're trying to solve problems that emerge earlier than when somebody joins the military. And I was looking at some of the numbers, and Norway has one of the highest per capita rates of Olympic medalists in the world. There's clearly a culture around health and fitness there that is different than in a lot of other countries. So I don't know what my question is, but like, can you talk about what that culture is, what makes that possible, and how that supports building the kind of military force you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that's important. It's of course embedded in our culture. If you go out in Norway around the lake on a Sunday, it's a lot of people out walking. So it's basically a tradition, of course, being physically active. But we are also getting more and more. We are always, as we say, like 10 to 20 years after the US. So it's coming here as well, of course, because we are wealthy and people have a good life in general. It's less physical work, of course, but people still try to eat pretty healthy and take care of their body. It's in the culture, but for the military and particularly the special forces, it's about the same number that applies every year. And what we have seen from the everybody in the military are or every young 19-year-old are enrolled in the military in Norway. So what we see is that the 3,000 meter, because that's tested on everybody, it's the mean time or the average time is going down, but the top 10% is the same. So you just get a bigger, what can we say, classification between the two groups. Like the top 10%, they are still the top 10% as they have always been, but maybe the average is going a little bit down based on physical form, body weight, and so on. So we discussed that a lot, and of course, when we saw that the average physical form was maybe going a little bit down compared to like the 70s and 80s, we saw that the 10% is still the 10%. So yeah, so we didn't feel we had any problems getting good applicants to the special forces, at least.
What kind of as a follow on, and I know I asked you this question when we spoke earlier in the week, but I think it fits here because speaking about the culture, I'm curious what you took from your background as you were working on your PhD, coming from a track and field space. Myself, having been around European strength and conditioning, it's very different from American strength and conditioning. It seems, at least to me, to be more analytical and methodical in its approach versus loud music and football players. And we see the loud music and football player stuff coming into the military as we take coaches from that space. So for you and your background, surrounded by that culture, coming into this position, creating a program, fitting that into the tactical culture of NorNavStock, where was your head at in terms of what right or what you thought right would look like getting started in that role?
Another good question. I think track and field has the longest history in the training literature. Matveyev, the old Russian guys, Bondarchuk, of course. In track and field, I feel it's less of a coincidence if you succeed. It's really a long-term plan. It's very systematic. And of course, that's my background as well. You can't trust on luck when you go to the Olympic every fourth year in one of the, what can we say, biggest sports in the world. And it's maybe you have worked for a year just to improve 1% on one capacity. So you really have to work very systematically over years. And I think that was maybe one of the things that I think also they liked it, but it was the biggest change. It was a totally new systematic approach to training, both with, of course, trying things out, full control over volume and reps and sets, and intensity. And also a lot more individualized than they had been used to do. In track and field. And I think in Norway, that's also maybe one of our success criteria for the Olympic medals that we take is that the training is very individualized. Even though you do the same sport, you have the same demands. We are very different as persons and with our genetics and capacities. And I brought also that in to the unit because we also have operators, like I said, 2 meters, 120 kilos, and we have operators that's 175 centimeters and 75 kilos. So do they need the same? Well, although they do the same job. So I was really important for me to include the individualized focus on the training and their training. In addition, we don't have many athletes, or we have many good athletes, but let's say if it's wrestling and we have a very good talent in wrestling that may take a medal in the Olympics, we only have one. We don't have 10 in each weight category, so we can kill all of them, and if or 9 out of 10, and if one survive, then we are happy. We just have one. And it's the same in all events in track and field. We don't have four or five guys that can run sub 10 on the 100 meter. It's one. So you really have to work on that talent. And as a coach, you don't get a lot of chances because it's not 10 talents or huge talents in each event. And I think that's also important, was an important aspect when I got in. These guys, they have been really hard selected. It's just a few that gets through. And in my thought was that I really have to work as good as I can to get everybody as good as they can be, each person. And that's also an important aspect. Another thing is, when I was a younger coach, I think my volume, my training is intensity on my athletes was just insane. Because you read studies, and it's basically about to maximize an effect in 8 weeks. That's what they do. It's not possible for an athlete to do 4 times 8 RM in squat 4 times per week. That's impossible, but you can do it for a short period, of course. But training is a process over years. So it's also about finding what's the smallest dose you can do and still get better. And that's of course different. Some people get better with a large dose, and some people they can have huge improvement with a really small dose. So it took me some years. I guess I was closer to 40 or at least 35 when I understood that, how little you can do with somebody and they still get better, and how much others have to do to get an adaption. But we basically base a lot of our understanding of training on research, and that's just the average of a group. And luckily now more and more studies have come with the individual responses to different strength programs, and I really like that they show that more than just the mean and the standard deviation. And that was also very important for me when I got into the unit. And I think particularly for the special forces, it's an extremely hard life. You have about 150 to 250 days per year traveling. You have a family, a lot of them have. And it's extremely hard training when you're home and then you deploy. So it's about finding what's the smallest or the least we can do, and you still improve.
Did you have, I mean, as you're talking, a million questions come to mind, but one of the ones that stands out is one that we know here coaches struggle with, especially as they're coming into these organizations and they're the new guy and typically the civilian. And CrossFit comes to mind as something that coaches have to compete against. But then you mentioned that idea of finding the minimum effective dose. And I mean, I can only speak to the American military culture, but it's very much like if some is good, more is better. So even if I come in as a coach with an understanding of what you just laid out, which is that the minimum effective dose is all we need to move the needle. Yeah, that's great. I'll do your workout. I'm also coming in this afternoon with my buddies, and we're going to do 8 Murphs back to back with weight vests on because we're tactical. Was that something that you had to nuance to create buy-in and compliance, or was the culture itself ripe for what you had to say?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I had to work a lot on that. And I'm in some ways, I can what can we say? I can be positive to CrossFit if that's what you're doing. But for soldiers or athletes, you cannot train like that. You will never last for years. But I think I was a little bit lucky because the unit had, of course, done some CrossFit and they had some CrossFit coaches before me, but they were all wrecked and injured, all of them. So I started on a pretty good wave. Of course, I can understand that they do it because it feels tactical that you have to push really hard. You use your whole body. You don't really know what you're going to do because every session can be different. But I think that was also when I was around them after about 6 months talking to them about training, how it works, and explaining how it's difficult to have control with CrossFit, because we could do a CrossFit session with a whole group, let's say 15, 20 guys, and it would maybe be easy for two of them and insane hard for 10 of them and about moderate session for the rest. So is it then a good session? Was the aim to make the session really hard? Of course, sometimes I just included Fatal 40 or a Linda or any CrossFit session just to test their will. But if you base your whole training on that, then it's very difficult to have control over volume and intensity over time. And I feel if we did it, or if we included any of the concepts, then the aim of the session was to test their will, not to get stronger or more fit. So it's just every session in my program have an aim, so they really know what they are focusing on. So it's either power, hypertrophy, anaerobic endurance, aerobic endurance. So you just know when you see the program that this is the focus of the session today. And sometimes it could be a circuit training or a cross, I like to call it circuit training. And then the aim was to train another capacity. And of course, if you choose to do a CrossFit type of session with the military, it's extremely important that you really think through what kind of exercises you include there. Because it's okay to have a high pace or tempo with so-called safe exercises. But if you have done let's say a 500 meter on the rowing ergometer as hard as you can, and then you're going to max your deadlift afterwards. It's just crazy in my head. Why? If you can do it, then you don't have to train on it. So of course, all the exercises that I included in those kind of sessions were a bit safer, that you can do them with a bit lower technical capacity. Another thing, I talked a lot to them. A lot of them were in really good shape. They were strong, very fit. So we had guys that could clean up to 150 kilos and snatch over 100 kilos. And as I say, the stronger you get, the higher is the risk that something happens if you start to do these things when you're really tired. So I think it's okay for a mom 40 years old in the street to go on a CrossFit session. Of course, you don't break your neck on 30 kilos in clean and jerk. But if you can do some repetitions on 130, 140 kilos, then yeah, something can happen. So we try to get a good separation between those sessions, that they had to know what the aim of this session was.
As you're saying that, what comes to mind for me is a conversation around metrics. And where I want to go with this is to ask you, for that unit and that organization, you mentioned the you don't have a huge bench. Like, the depth is not there. You've got to treat each one of these guys individually. You can't really run the risk of creating a lot of injuries. One thing that I think the American military has struggled with for a long time is, how do you show return on investment for these programs. Certainly we could look at PT test scores and great, you went from a 580 to a 600, whatever the number is. For you guys though, what did that look like when you were sitting in front of leadership, briefing them on the efficacy of your program? What were you guys measuring?
Yeah, important question. Of course, you need to get something in return. And of course, it was a big investment for them as well to hire me. And they also invested a lot of time in training when I was there. It's also money for the unit. So in the Norwegian Navy Special Forces, it's 5 training sessions per week in their work time. So, of course, I had a possibility to actually do something. 2 is not enough, but we had 5 sessions per week. So that was, of course, great. But
that's, and those also, were protected. That was protected time.
Yeah. For and of course, that's also a lot of money if you think about salary and everything. So, of course, we tested every 6 months, a lot of different tests, both aerobic capacity, anaerobic capacity, power, strength upper body, strength lower body. That was maybe the easiest part, to just show the improvements. And of course, it gives confidence. The system higher up always likes that their soldiers are getting better. I could, of course, have a big focus on what I knew we would improve fast if it's 1 or 2 capacities before the tests, just to bump it up. That's not very difficult when you have 5 sessions per week if you want to work really hard on something for a month or so. In terms of injuries, I collected the injuries on them. So that's not published yet, but I guess I can do it soon. But we had about 30% reduction in injuries over for the first 4 years, which is, of course, incredible. It's a lot of money. And we don't have, like, it's not thousands of soldiers. So it's very important that the ones that we have are ready, that they can actually do their work. So that was important. Of course, I showed those data to the people running the economy, because then they really see what they get back. We spend millions of Norwegian kroners educating one operator, and if he's out for a year, then it's a lot of money for the military and the unit, and of course for the person himself, because they really want to do their job.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned testing protocols. Yeah. And as I mentioned right before this, I was just watching cool videos about Norwegian special operations testing protocols. So I got to ask directly, yeah, for NORNAVSOC, what testing events did you use?
Yeah, I started out really wide. This was in around 2012. Started out with a pretty large test battery the first year. And it was for several reasons. I wanted to know as much as I could, of course. I also had to check what are others doing, because mm-hmm. you can just make your own tests, but do you know if that's a good result or not? You have to compare it with something to say whether it's a good result or not. I could also, of course, just find up a lot of funny tests that nobody are doing, and then we improve on those. But I had to check what are the other similar units, both in Norway, around the world, in sport, what are they doing? So we basically started with, for strength, it was bench press, which is pretty easy to get some comparable results. We did leg press instead of squats, just in the beginning, because I didn't really know a lot about their technique. We did pull-ups, of course, which a lot of them do. We call it the brutal bench. It's an abdominal test.
Yes. This appeared in the, I can't remember if it was the Coastal Commandos or the Long Range Reconnaissance guys, but for those listening, a brutal bench is kind of like a suspended sit-up. Imagine you took a normal bench and like bolted it to the wall And so the down position is you hanging down along the bench and you have to do like a full sit up, at
head
least to
down,
flattens.
like
Yeah,
you're
head
upside
down.
down,
Head down.
for reps.
Head down
Yeah.
for reps. Yep.
Okay.
So
And your
just
legs are locked
hanging.
in. There's like a pad holding your foot and stuff. It's pretty cool.
So you're just hanging straight down, and you have to get your elbows above your knees to get one repetition approved. That's been used in sports. I don't really like any of the abdominal strength tests at all, but maybe it's one of them that's okay. Of course, it's a lot of hip adductors, but well, it's still a test that we can actually standardize pretty well, and it's not just the plank or sit-ups or whatever that's impossible to standardize. So it was, of course, important to be able to standardize the tests pretty or decently at least. So that was the four strength tests. For speed and power, we did standing long jump, counter movement jump on the force plate. So I wanted both just to compare. Med ball toss, knee standing, and the 5-10-5 agility test. So that was for strength and power. So four tests there as well. For endurance, we did VO2 max on a treadmill and Oxycon mixed chamber. So that was a lot of work testing all the guys on the full VO2 test. But I was okay. And then 3,000 meter run, because that's just a tradition in addition. So that was the performance test. And then we made one test that was the only one, and that was the EVAC test. So it's basically, you have a fireman's doll weighing 90 kilos, and you have to sprint 40 meters, take the doll and sprint or carry it through a 40 meter course back again. We also did some FMS mobility in the beginning, but I just stopped doing that after a year. That was just a waste of time.
Thank you for saying that.
Just useless. And of course, it came up studies that show that there's no correlation to injuries or whatever, and it was basically because I had seen others doing it. I had never done it in sport or with my athletes, but I thought, all right, we can test it, and maybe you get some focus on some mobility aspects. But I talked to them every day in training about it anyway, so. But we did it in the beginning, and then we measured also a full DEXA scan on all the guys with the lean mass, fat mass, and body mass. So it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, yeah, 16 to 18 tests in the beginning.
So
So
it seems like you're moving in a direction of explaining which ones you trimmed off and changed and things like that. You like narrowed your shot group a little bit. I know Drew already commented on FMS. A question I had, and I honestly didn't know this until about 2 to 3 minutes ago as I was like looking up stuff on you while we were talking, but you were co-author on a paper about like force velocity individualization, where you guys concluded, and I'll just quote it here, the results from this study do not support the efficacy of individualized training based on force velocity profiling.
For
Curious
people that
about
don't know
whether.
what efficacy means, that means he's saying that force plates are not good.
Well, I'm curious, is that what you're saying, and how did that affect the testing?
I like I said, I always have an open mind, and I really want to test stuff. And I have to be sure that it works or not. Otherwise, we just don't do it anymore. And it's the same here. Now I am the head of strength and power at the Olympic Federation in Norway. I just had a PhD student, and he did 5-6 studies on force velocity profiling. So we have tested a lot of different ways of both measuring it, looking at the reliability of it, and of course on athletes. We have tested different training protocols, and I think it's 5-6 studies out there. I can send them to you if you want. I'm now working on a meta-analysis as well on force velocity profiling. So yeah, it's just 7 or 8 studies that have done interventions. But I think people tend to just swallow a new concept that comes up, and we have to do this. We can test if they are force dominated or velocity dominated in a very simple way, and train them towards one of them. So We have tested it, and we don't really find the same results as Morin and his group. I think it's several reasons for it. We did a placebo study that was really cool. So we divided them in two groups and tested their profile, whether they were force or velocity deficient. And then we took half of the both groups were both force and velocity deficient. And half on the first group, they were told that here you have the optimal program for you to get either, your jumping capacity will get better. And the other group, that was the control group, they were told that you are in the control group, so here's your program. But both of them got optimal program in terms of the profile. And then it was no difference. Because you basically see 5 to 10% improvement in most studies. And we know that the placebo effect or the expectation effect is about 5%. So it have to be better than that. Actually, the placebo group was a little bit better because they really thought that they got the optimal program. So, but they didn't. So, yeah.
So the trick here is just to tell everyone that you did a bunch of science and you got an optimal program. Here you go.
It's same as happened a lot of the early psychological testing. If you just put on a white coat and say you're a doctor, you can actually fool a lot of people.
So I would just want to make sure we stay on the track we were on before. You had your wide shotgun blast testing approach where you're testing 15 different things and you eventually trimmed some things off. What did you come to as the final version of the assessment you used?
CrossFit.
definitely.
Was Fran.
Yeah. Oh, it was 1 RM curls. No, I'm just kidding. It was important to take several considerations into mind. It's, how comprehensive is the testing and the test battery, time consuming and money, which is important. It had to be pretty simple to do and not take too much time, and it had to give me an answer that I needed to be able to help them. So if I really want to help them in training, the test had to tell me what they needed to improve. So we basically ended up with of course pull-ups, which is had always been there before I came in as well, and a lot of units do that. And I think it's an important asset for the at least the Navy special operations. They, of course, if you want to board a big ship, you have to climb, you have to pull yourself over the wreck, the fence. So that was okay. And then we did, we changed to trap bar from leg press after a while. So 3 RM, not 1 RM. And then we did the standing long jump. That was basically correlated 0.9 with the counter movement jump. So, and it's easier. Actually, in many studies as well, you have a lower or a better reliability on the standing long jump than the counter movement jump. So, and it's cheap and easy. The 5-10-5 agility we tended to include. Power upper body is very difficult to test. So the med ball toss went out. Just too much variation based on your technique or your daily shape. And then we kept the 3,000 meter run. They have to do that every year anyway in the Norwegian military. So we kept that. And that was basically it. And the evacuation test we kept. The evacuation test is measuring a lot of different capacities. It's measuring a little bit speed, some endurance. It lasts for about 50 seconds, so it's anaerobic capacity. You have to be pretty strong because the doll is 90 kilos. So that was the average of the unit. So we knew that you could actually carry most of the guys for a while, and you need some speed, some muscle mass, some leg strength. And I kept that Because if I really didn't know, or let's say one of the operators had one test that was below the average, then I could look at their evac test and see whether it was low on that as well, on the military or the tactical test or whatever. And then for me, at least, it gave me an idea about maybe if we improve that special capacity, if it's a trap bar or standing long jump, then maybe we'll improve his evac test. Because I also feel that many people include just or only a test battery that includes all the test includes a lot of different capacities, like an obstacle course or the evac test. And for me, it's impossible to know what you have to improve if you suck on the test. It could be technique, it could be your aerobic shape, it could be your strength, it could be, yeah. So that's why we just included one of those, and the others were pure. So two strength tests, one power test for the legs, and one agility or change of direction. That's actually what it is, not a real agility test, because you decide yourself when you want to go. And one aerobic capacity, and the evac test was anaerobic capacity, basically. Of course, we did a testing on the, let's say, shooting range. I took them to, instead of, you have seen biathlon, skiing and shooting. It's a military.
It's very Norwegian.
Yeah, it's very Norwegian. You guys do well in that event.
Yeah, we do. And that's also based on older military exercises. But I used to just test them a little bit. So we took three times 300 meter uphill. So you just run up as fast as you can with your full gear, your vest, whatever. You walk down, run up again, walk down, run up again, and then straight on the shooting range. Five shots on 100 meter, with 180 plus in heart rates. And then I could just correlate their shooting results with the aerobic capacity or the test. And what we basically saw is that the higher the VO2 max or the better 3,000 meter run, the better they could shoot with a higher heart rate.
Vince Bykowski is cheering you on right now, one of our former podcast guys.
But that was easier for me just to have a pure test battery. And then, of course, I tested this to some of the capacities that we thought was or could be important. But of course, that's a physically induced heart rate. What most of these guys feel in real action is, of course, a psychologically induced heart rate, which is a bit different, but it's still high. So I did a lot of measurements on the close combat clearance courses and just put up a big screen in a shooting house, like you have in a spinning hall, with all the heart rates of everybody, and we could just follow them and check them. And it was really interesting to see how that changed based on the scene or the trial that they had, the difficulty of it. But we still could correlate that the better physical capacity you had, the better you performed on a lot of these exercises. So that was, of course, also important to show to the command, in addition, so I could just underline the importance of a good physical capacity.
So, knowing Drew, he's going to want to talk to you a little bit about how that stuff actually played out in operational missions and things like that. But before he does, I got to sneak in a couple quick riffs here. One, appreciate the differentiation between change of direction and agility.
Yeah, thank you for saying that.
No,
Same with ladder, same with agility ladders. That's not agility.
That's exactly why everybody talks about agility ladders. But for the people listening, if you're not clear on why we're digging into the semantics, agility involves reaction to an outside stimulus, not
sense.
deciding yourself when you change
Heaven
direction.
forbid
Never.
someone look up the definition of agility.
Anyway, we
Anyway.
don't need to go too far down that rabbit hole. Nobody really cares. What I wanted to observe is that you guys ditched all of the most quote unquote technical tests. You're no longer doing the like gas exchange, VO2 max assessment. You're no longer doing the force velocity curve stuff. You're not doing the things that are supposed to be like new and sexy and sciencey, and you reverted to things that like you observed do seem to have greater reliability, even though they aren't like sexy and new and technical and digital and things like that. And I don't really have a question. I just think that's an interesting outcome.
I want to comment on that because I've published over 40 papers now, done a lot of research. And what we basically see is that the more gear you get in, you know, the more hardware error do you have as well, in addition to the biological error of the person, the day-to-day variation. So even in a counter movement jump, you have the force plate, you have the software calculating the jump height, which can be different, and you have the person. So the error is typically around 5%, the coefficient of variation. So that means that I need to get an improvement above 5% to be sure it's not just a variation. But for standing long jump sprints, it's 2%. But if you try to publish a paper doing standing long jump, they say, why didn't you use a force plate? And I have to argue with the reviewers that, well, I know it's simple, but it's better. You know, it's and we know that.
Yes.
So it's the same with RFD, you know, a very good, nice concept from the physiology. But if you look at the coefficient of variation in RFD, it's over 20% because you really don't know where on the curve you should take it out. So then the test is useless. So, and it's the same with force velocity profiling. The difficulty is the velocity side because you're so far away from venal, or you know, because you have your body weight, so you're far away from venal, and then you just extrapolate the line and you think it's straight line, but it's not, it's curving. So on the venal, the variation is huge and the reliability is really low. And of course, when you make a profile on 2 points, you have a variation in force and a variation in velocity, and you make a line through that on 5 attempts. On the slope, the CV will be above 15%. How can I get an athlete better or improve more than 15%? If I have a top athlete that's trained for 10 years, and for me, when I do a test or should talk about the test, you have to improve more than variability on the test.
Just want to underline that we'll keep the conversation going, but that's important.
I want to ask you, I'm really curious as to your thoughts on this, because we're talking a lot about testing, and I remember, similar to you, I came into an organization in special operations that did not have a history of embedded human performance. And so when you get there, one of the first things that you think to do is, okay, we're going to look at a series of tests. We're going to baseline everybody. We're going to get these numbers, and then we'll train to improve those things. And kind of like you, I went through a series of different evolutions and setups and stuff. But one of the things that I realized was there doesn't seem to be, and this is where I'm curious as to your thoughts, there doesn't seem to be a great carryover between gym-based performance testing and combat effectiveness. And what I mean by that is I would see guys that would be on the low end of the metrics that I'm collecting, but they would go deploy and then come back, and you would hear stories of like, that's the guy that saved everyone's life. That's the guy that engaged with the enemy. That's the guy that was the most combat effective. And so it just kind of, for me, created this interesting dichotomy of, okay, I'm gonna work to improve your performance on these gym-based tests, but have I improved your ability to perform your quote-unquote sport? And I don't know if you can actually ever connect those dots because of how chaotic combat truly is, but I'm just curious where you sit with that, because you seem to have done so much work in that space.
Yeah. Oh, I've done a lot of thinking, at least, on that. I totally agree with you. For me, I used the testing more as a confidence measure on them, that either we had worked on something and they improved a little bit on one of them, or I was never very focused on getting everybody average, you know, on the test. You had some strengths, you could improve those and just get better than the others. And if you had some real weaknesses, and we tried to work a little bit on that at the same time as they worked on their strengths. I actually did a small experiment, hasn't been published as well, of course, it's just in my numbers, but I asked a lot of the guys who is the best operator, and you get some names, you know, and I got a name list of about 10 operators that tended to be mentioned often by the others as a very good soldier, a very good operator. They were about average on the testing. The best guys, they maybe, what can you say? They tend to spend more time on themselves, on training. They are in the gym 2 times per day, and of course they have good physique. But the other guys, they had just a different opinion about them. So I remember the question was, who would you take to with you to war? And then I just got some names, and maybe that's the best place where we can put them. That's where that average is. Maybe that's enough, at least. And I totally agree. I think it's always nice when we can show that it's some correlation to shooting with heart rate, and but you don't need to be extreme. You have to be okay, and of course have a right mindset. And in our unit, the team player or the team focus is very big. So you also have to have good social aspects, social communication skills. Yeah, be a nice guy, actually.
Well, and as you say that, I think about something that Alex and I have been talking about, and we've made this phrase up, performance peripherals, mostly because the phrase sounds sexy. But this comes up a lot. The ability to communicate with your peers, the ability to have some emotional intelligence, the ability to work in a team. That to me is just as important, if not more important, than your 3 rep max deadlift or your 5-10-5 agility slash change of direction score. And so I'm curious again, just to your thoughts on this, because one of the things that I think we're starting to tease out with MOPS and MOS is that there is this laser focus on tangible objective performance. And we pay lip service to mental health and we pay lip service to cognitive performance and these other pieces. But man, the more we talk to people like you, the more we realize that stuff is incredibly important. So, do you see a future world of human performance where we do a good job of integrating that the same way that we seem to do such a good job testing people's 3 rep max deadlift?
Yeah, definitely. It's extremely important. We are now doing a study actually with the Nordnorsk. Of course, I talk to them a lot and still work with them. So, and we just try to measure all the psychological skills that they feel is important to be a good operator. And it's still the team leader comes out first, or the team spirit or team guy. You have to be a team player. That's what they say. And whether that can be taught, I think to a similar to a certain degree at least. And of course, we see now that more and more from sports psychology, from psychologists coming into the units. But you may have to work a while on that. But I feel the guys, they are really honest, and they you bet you will hear it if you're an asshole pretty quick. And of course, if you don't learn from that, then you have a problem. But most people, they tend to get better at better when they're in the unit as well. But we should definitely have at least, or yeah, a lot more focus, or the same focus on those aspects. The same is with confidence, you know, it's that's what it's about. If you're standing outside a door in a, let's say, a classroom or whatever, you don't really know what's inside there. It could be two enemies, it could be four. And you know you have to ram down that door and just run into that room. You better feel confident to do that. And whether it helps to have 70 on the VO2 max or biceps, big biceps, I think big biceps is better. But at least for some. So confidence is also very important. So I always use training and testing to build their confidence. You never try to focus too much on the weaknesses. And that's maybe where we are learned a bit in school, I guess, or through health and physiotherapy. You have to improve your weaknesses all the time. But for these guys, it's about just feeling good, and that you're ready and you're confident. So the focus in our training was also more and more away from the weaknesses toward the strengths. I talked a lot to them, what makes you feel good, you know? And then up to deployments, we tried to work on those capacities, so they felt good when they left into their competition.
So you brought that up in our conversation before we did this episode, and I was about to get to it if you didn't do it there. And I just want to like kind of rephrase it to make sure the point is driven home. Everybody's familiar with a spider plot of performances. So you can see which events you're a high performer on and low performer on. You're trying to get the biggest area inside the plot and all that stuff. But what you're saying is it's not so much about always training the weaknesses, because there's a psychological piece and like a performance potential piece that goes into always hammering your weaknesses. What you've proposed here is that you just have to make sure they're good enough on the weaknesses, like figure out where the floor is on those, make sure they hit it, and then allow them to chase those things that they're good at and that they love. And they get to experience performing highly and like looking good and feeling good and things like that. And I think there's a really important takeaway in there, because that runs counter to a lot of what is out there in the tactical space right now.
I'm sure that's the right way to go, at least for the special forces. Of course, they have a, well, I think it's been rated the world's hardest job for 10 years now. It's a mental game, of course. So if you really like, or your identification is to have a really good bench press, that's your identification in life, to be strong in bench press. Should I take that away from that person to make him run a lot better? Well, I'm not sure whether he's getting a better soldier if he can improve his 3K run a lot and get a lot weaker in bench press. Of course, we try to bump it up a little bit. When we put up the demands on the testing, like the work capacity analyzed, then of course I presented, this is the average of the unit. That's, and here's the standard deviation. Most of you are in this area. And then I show them the data from the other units or papers published, some sports. And after, I guess it was the third or fourth time we tested, so it was year two, then I figured I had a pretty good idea of their physique. So I just put up all the tests on the Hill's curve, or the normal distribution curve, I mean. And this is the average. And then you have guys on both sides. And then we discussed, all right, what should the minimum or the have to demand be on the test? Like this is what the minimum you have to do. And then we looked at the average, and then we just divided it in percentiles. And then it was a discussion about how many percent away from the mean of the operators can you be on that test as the weakest that we will accept. And then for the should demand, that was actually them decided. I just showed them this is the 60%, the 70th percentile, the 80th percentile, and I showed them the result on that. And then it was a discussion within the squadrons, and then they decided that we should be here. It was always a little bit above the mean, of course, like on the 70th percentile or whatever on the test. And then the minimum is here. So it was basically, because we put together different teams from different squadrons based on their expertise. So you just need to know that everybody's okay. So that was the idea with the have to or the minimum demand. So we always had two demands, and the should demand was a little bit confidence. They felt that, all right, we should be here on this, or our squadron should be the best on this, or yeah. But the minimum, that was also a nice thing. It was a great acceptance among the operators and in the unit that if you are not above the minimum after a year, then you could be held back from deploying.
So I noticed that same phenomenon in both of the videos I was watching before this with the Coastal Ranger Commandos and with the Long Range Reconnaissance guys, is that for every test event, each of the operators could identify, this is the minimum, this is what you got to get, this is what you should get, what you should be aiming for. And then for a lot of the events, they also knew what the record was. So you have like the floor, the target, and the stretch goal for every event. And they all had like familiarity around those and knew where they stood on a lot of events and things like that. I think that's a pretty cool framework.
The coastal rangers, they were at trainer courses in with me, of course. So so that's how we worked it out. I had like a human performance course for the different units in Norway and our own operators 2 times per year as well, just to educate them. Because I couldn't be everywhere with the guys as well. So they really needed to understand why we're doing this and how should I do it and so on.
Awesome. A couple others to underline. Drew's going to have a couple closing questions for you, but I just want to underline a couple others that you alluded to here that I
Can we
thought
just
were.
pause and comment how cool like Coastal Ranger sounds?
It does sound pretty
That's a
cool.
pretty cool job title.
I will link both videos in the show notes because they're pretty neat stuff.
It is. And of course, in the Nordnavsuk is
Sounds way cooler when you say it.
the Nordnavsuk. Yeah, that's the US or the shortening, but it's
Can you say
actually
the like the MJK name? Can you give us that one? There it
Marinejeger
is.
on both.
There it is.
Man, I'm just
But
picturing a bunch of
the thing
Vikings like.
I can show you our shirt. I just brought it up. If you say it in, if we just directly translate a Norwegian Navy Special Operation group to English, it's actually a Marine Jäger. A Jäger is a hunter in Norwegian.
Do you guys, when you jump in to combat, would you call that a Jaeger bomb?
We have our own bar, and it's of course a Jäger bomb there. It is.
I hope I
I don't know
get
if you can
shit for
see
that.
it, it's not clear, but this is our t-shirt, and you can see what's on
The
there.
Viking laws.
The Viking
Yes.
laws. So we have four laws: be brave, aggressive, be prepared, be a good merchant, keep the camp in order. So that's the four Viking laws. And when we go to US, of course, and everybody wants the t-shirts, of
I
course.
was okay. I was gonna ask that because we had a guy come on British physical fitness school, and they have really cool shirts. And I'm assuming yours are not available online.
No,
Damn it!
unfortunately.
Bummer.
Fine. If I meet
Anyway,
you, well, we'll see.
deal, Alex. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, all good. I want to underline a couple other things that you've alluded to already in this conversation, but I just want to make sure people don't miss out on some key takeaways here, and then I'll hand it off to Drew for some closers. But you mentioned like pre-deployment bench press and bicep curls. You mentioned like the feeling of your uniform sleeves being tight on your arms, making you feel ready to kick down a door. And I just want to give you a chance to talk about the role that like even if the actual exercise doesn't correlate with the actual performance, the feeling, the confidence that comes with it has relevance to how people behave. And I just want to give you a second to talk about that.
Thanks for taking it up. I think it's extremely important because we really can't measure or totally understand what's going on in combat. It's always changing. The enemy is doing better, doing something different. It's very difficult to prepare as we do in sport because we know what we meet, we know what time they are going to compete, we know how the surface is, we know where we are. So just working on how you feel that your body is functional, you feel good, is extremely important, I think. And it was up to Afghanistan, then we knew that it's difficult to train endurance capacity down there because of the air. So they had to do a certain amount of endurance capacity back home before they left. But in addition to that, it was working on their strength or what motivated them or what made them feel good. So that was basically our focus. And I think that's extremely important not to take away from these guys, at least on this level. Like you say, bench press or biceps curls, it really doesn't matter as if the uniform is a bit tight around your shoulders and your arms, you tend to feel good.
Awesome. I feel like a few people listening will be appreciating that right
Well,
now, and
somebody's
maybe
gonna say just buy a smaller uniform, but yeah.
also true.
Point taken.
Last one here I want to underline, because in my previous job, we definitely saw this play out in a few different units as being important and valuable. But you talked at the top of the episode about how important it was that you had an operator assigned with you, at least for your first 6 months on the job, to help you understand the unit, what was going on, even just show you around, those kind of things. But like before we close out, I just want to give you a second to talk about like what that gave you in terms of advantages, what that allowed you to do with your program by having somebody who was an actual member of the organization that was, I don't know what you would call it, but like they, part of their duties were assigned specifically to integrating human performance into the unit.
That was extremely important. Like I said, I think I came out pretty well because they had tried different things, which was not very successful. But and I think they knew or they had heard about me, of course, and my background, my education, and so on. But you still need that extra in addition to what you have done in another setting. And that was where the operator was extremely important, and of course the access to everything. You could talk to the right guys. I was able to, of course, sit down with the planners, trying to get time to training, for example, on exercises. I could say that, hey, can we find a few hours to train on that day, and economy. Then, of course, I made programs to those guys, and they were really happy, and I got more money to do funny stuff. So it was extremely important just in the beginning to know who should I talk to get, or to be able to help the operators to get things done. And it made it a lot easier because it's a little bit different environment than what I was used to. But I still think the training principles still count. It's not that because you're a warrior or an athlete, training is training, and adaptation to training is still adaptation to training. So of course it was very important to me to not go too far away from the basics in training, but it helped me to get things going a lot quicker.
I'm curious. So I have this question, and then I have a very, very serious closer that I can't wait to hear your answer to. But you're no longer with these guys. You're now with at the Olympic Training Center. And I'm just curious to hear what you took from this sort of chapter of your life. I guess both personally, but then also just from the training perspective, what you took from that into your role now.
That's a lot. I learned a lot about, first of all, training, of course, a lot about planning training. And of course, when you work every day on trying to get adaptation to training improvements in an environment that is not really optimal to get it because of the little sleep, a lot of traveling, a lot of stress. And I learned so much about controlling the intensity, about how we could, when can we push, when can we not, the importance of psychology, of course, So I brought all of that into now working with athletes as well. So of course now we, let's say if I put up a strength program, it's always intervals on the series. So it's like 3 to 5 times 5, and with reps in reserve, which we also used, of course, because that
Love that you
takes
said that. Thank you.
control over your daily variation. And then it's up to me to just, if you always choose the minimum in each series, let's say it's intervals or lifting, then I just have to make sure that's enough to get an adaption. You will still get better if you always choose minimum. And if you feel good, you can choose better that day. So I talked a lot to the guys and trying to make them listen to their body, how they feel, because some of them had slept nothing, others had a good night, and for some, the exercise had been really hard. For others, it's been okay. So that was very important. Of course, I measured the RPE, the perceived recovery status, like subjective, a lot, just to get an idea of how hard the different exercises had been, so I could plan the training in terms of that. I tested out so many periodization protocols, block periodization, linear, undulating, in those periods that we could. I tended to land on block periodization because it was easier to fit the different blocks with their work schedule. And I still use block periodization on most of my athletes, but not maybe the traditional block periodization with focus on just one capacity, or you have focus on one capacity but you maintain the other. So I also learned a lot about how little you need to do to maintain a capacity. It's basically enough with one session per week, and then you can maintain a capacity for at least 10 to 12 weeks. You just think you have to do more, but for maintenance, it's extremely little that you need to do. To improve, you have to do more. So I learned a lot about that as well. Of course, I saw many times what's a human being is possible to do. When the athletes complain about that they are tired or whatever, they know they shouldn't complain to me because they don't really know what it is. It's always 20% more in your belly. But I think also important with these guys, my main job was to actually put on the brakes a lot, because they're selected on being tough and going hard and eating rocks and everything. So it was basically, and of course that's also important as a coach to know when can you push and when should you put on the brakes. If you always push, you might improve a little while, but you will get damaged or injured, and it's the same with the athletes. In addition, I at the end of the period with the special operators, I never tested a capacity that I knew they would suck on or that they hadn't trained. So let's say we had a strength block, and then we just tested a strength because I wanted to find out what's the effect of that block, not the effect on the endurance capacity. And it's the same with the athletes. I'm just doing the block, and then we're testing how did that work. So of course, if they had their yearly 3,000 meter, we always put on an endurance block up to that. So they performed pretty well, felt good, or happy with the test. All right, then we move to the strength block. So yeah. Of course, I have a master's degree in sports psychology and a PhD in physiology slash psychology. So I think I used a lot of that, and I learned even more about how to use it in practice. The combination of physiology and psychology, which is extremely important in these environments, and also with athletes, the elite athletes.
I know Alex was smiling as soon as he started talking about autoregulation and reps in reserve, because We slam our heads into the wall with that over and over and over again, and people still don't seem to.
Never put up weights or percentage of RM or whatever. It's just reps in reserve
It's
and
like music to my ears to hear you say that.
you don't know, but 2 days ago, Drew and I recorded like a how-to 101 episode on using autoregulation and RPE and stuff. It'll publish probably a couple weeks after your episode does, to be honest. We're probably shuffling the order a little bit, but people can look forward to that soon too.
Nice. I'm gonna listen to that. Of course, we use the flexible periodization for periods as well,
Everything you say is just right. Thank you.
which is kind of an auto regulation because let's say they had an exercise that I knew was pretty hard, a diving exercise for 14 days up north in the sea. You're cold, it's 8 to 10 hours diving, and you're just a wreck. Then I just made the sessions. Pretty easy sessions, five, six of them. And then I said, if you can just do these within the 14 days, then that's good. And you choose what day you do it and just feel how, whether you should train today or not. And you can take it tomorrow if you feel better tomorrow. And then they also felt they could do all the session with a decent amount of quality as well, instead of just forcing in training every day.
Drew's preferred term is emergent periodization, where you allow the way the athlete is responding to drive the decisions about the future training.
Definitely. So we used that a lot when I wasn't there or exercises, but and it worked perfectly. It's a bit more difficult to improve a performance or peak performance with that, but they don't really need to peak a lot of times.
Okay, so this is the most important question of the day, I think. Thinking about being a coach in a gym in the American military and specifically special operations, huge, huge factor is the music. And you have these really tough guys, and I'll tell you, more often than not, you're typically hearing Taylor Swift or something similar. So I'm just curious. I picture in your environment just like heavy Viking metal, but I want to hear from you, what's kind of the go-to genre to get the Jaegers ready to roll? It can be Taylor Swift.
We tended to land on something like that.
Yes.
Yeah, like Pantera, Satyricon. Yeah, I guess it's the same all over the world.
There's some quality Viking metal kind of stuff out there that has made its way into my gym playlist occasionally.
If you just search up King by Satyricon, that's a Norwegian death metal or heavy black metal band. So yeah, something like that. So
Guaranteed to improve performance by 10%.
definitely either that or you have to put in some beautiful girls in their gym.
I love that. Yeah. Perfect. So it sounds like, look, everybody's doing the same thing, regardless of where we sit, man. Well, we say this every time we have folks on internationally because I know the time difference. I mean, you're basically in the future and it's late over there. So thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us. I know we're going to bump this episode way earlier in the order because I think there's some important pieces here for folks to take away. So thanks again for talking to us, not only today, but also earlier in the week to prep for it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. It's really interesting. And yeah, we'll see. Hopefully, we'll, or maybe in the future, we'll end up in the military again. We'll see.
We'll see.
This was awesome. Thanks.
Bottom line up front, when he started talking about autoregulation, I mean, we told him this, people won't know this because it was after we stopped the recording, but we talked about bringing him back on again in the future to speak more practically to that thing. Because as I mentioned, we talk about RPE and reps in reserve and autoregulation all the time. But just to hear somebody of his caliber coming to the same conclusion was like very reaffirming. Paul is what I would consider a cerebral human performance professional, which are my favorite kinds of people, because he takes a very analytical approach to how he trains athletes. And man, people should probably listen to this episode more than once.
There was a ton of goodness in that episode. I think Well, one, I didn't honestly like know his whole background, and the guy's got a fascinating path he followed of
We got
like
kidnapped.
the psychology piece of the whole thing, the fact that he was a national level athlete in his own right before coming on. I believe it was the javelin. He didn't technically mention that. But I believe he was a javelin athlete and then a javelin coach before he went down the strength and conditioning path, which is a super unique sport. If you guys want to see some crazy exercises, elite javelin athletes do some wild stuff that puts your spine in position that would be scary for most people. And
It seems like I'm just realizing this as you're talking, and I might get some heat for this, but that's fine. It seems like the most open-minded and I want to use the word contemporary, but like the most open-minded people, coaches in this space come from track and field. And it seems like the most dogmatic and this is the only way come from strength and power. And I'm thinking of like, oh, here you got to do 5-3-1, or you got to do 5x5, or you have to do that. I don't see as much of that from track and field. And I wonder if it has to do with something that he mentioned in the episode, which was that you have to be very individualized. You have to do the N of one type stuff that we've talked about. And so they are way more open to the idea of trying different things, and they recognize that there's a lot of variance between different types of athletes. I can't think off the top of my head of like a track and field based buy my ebook type coach. Anyway, I don't know if that's related to the episode or not, but it literally, as you were saying, I was like, huh.
but yeah, there's just so much. I mean, I'm gonna have to go when he started talking about like physically induced elevated heart rate versus psychologically induced elevated heart rate and how those influence performance differently. That's something to go check. I mean, we've talked about that in terms of how like heart rate isn't a perfect indicator of the stress level of an activity, because you could get a high heart rate from a scary movie or you could get a high heart rate from running. But just the I'm gonna have to go talk to some cognitive performance people on how like those different kinds of stressors influence performance differently. There was so much in here, man. Tons of goodness.
Yeah, and he mentioned this, and we'll include him in the show notes as I guess as many as we can, but he's published a lot, and I know I have come across his stuff. This was years ago before knowing him. Some really very practical studies. So I say that because most of the studies that you see in kind of the strength and conditioning journals, they don't really apply to anybody. I mean, it's just research published for the sake of publishing research, which is fine. But Paul's stuff historically has always stood out to me because you will see the interventions that they used, the things that they took from that. There's a lot of stuff that you can use to apply to your own training. And I've done that in the past with some folks that I've worked with. So if you liked the things that he said, there's a plethora of information out there and content that he's created. And we'll highlight as much of it as we can, but inevitably there will be more.
There's some neat stuff in there. He alluded to the one about placebo effect stuff, and there's a paper he's an author on titled "The Effects of Being Told You Are in the Intervention Group on Training Results." That's one
That's
I
pretty
definitely now
cool.
have. That's on my to be re read list for sure. There's some good stuff here. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, we'll close this one out, but thanks again for listening, and we will see you guys next week. Bye. Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, Our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.